When he reached the foot of the hill that Alku turned toward him, I conveyed to Gush or Grinpok your desire of acquiring the various magic powers which you mentioned, he said. Rimpok's reply was that he has not got the books which you must study in his Ritod. A full collection of them exists in the library of my monastery, so Rinpoch has desired me to take you there, in order that you may begin work. There is a horse for you, you will travel with my trippers. Then he left Karma and joined the small group of the dignitaries of his Gompa who had accompanied him in his journey. All turned towards the hermitage, respectfully bowed their farewell to the invisible anchorite, vaulted into the saddle, and started at full trot. Karma remained motionless, lost in amazement. A tripper gave him a push and put the bridle of a horse in his hand. He found himself on the back of the beast trotting fast with the lama's attendants before he had realized what happened. The fourth day after his arrival at the Gompa, a tripper informed Karma that, according to the Tulku's order, the collection of books mentioned by Kushong Top's Jiyas had been carried into Achamkang. He could begin his study at once. Food would be sent regularly to him from the monastery. Karma followed his guide and was led uphill to a tiny pleasantly situated whitewashed house. From the window he could look down on the monastery with its gilded roofs and beyond it a valley enclosed by woody slopes. Inside the cell, next a small altar, 30 big potis 154 carefully wrapped in their robes, boti, and tied between. Tibetan books are made of detached oblong sheets of paper and usually wrapped in a piece of cloth, cotton or often silk, which is called their robe, namza. Spelt, nabza. Of carved boards, were placed on several shelves. A wave of joyful pride swept across Karma's mind. At last, someone had begun to treat him with proper respect. The tripper informed him that the Tulku did not wish him to remain in strict seclusion. He was at liberty to live as he liked, to fetch his water at the stream nearby, and to walk outside wherever and whenever he wished. Left alone, Karma buried himself in the books. He learned by heart a large number of magic formulas, built scores of kayak whores, using more sampa and butter to make the tormas than for his meals. He also practiced the many various meditations described in the treatises. For about 18 months, his zeal did not slacken. He went out only to fetch water, did not speak a single word to the trippers who twice a month brought him his food and fuel supply, and never so much as glanced through his window at the world outside. Then, slowly, thoughts that had never occurred to him crept into his mind during his meditations. Certain words of the books, certain figures of the mystic diagrams appeared to him as pregnant with significations formerly unsuspected. He often stood long in front of his window, watching the monks going in and out of the monastery. Finally, he walked across the hills, examining the plants and pebbles, looking attentively at the clouds traveling in the sky, observing the ever-flowing water of the stream, the play of the lights and shadows. He also spent hours watching the villages scattered in the valleys below, the peasants working in the fields, the animals passing loaded on the roads and those who roamed free across the pasture grounds. Every evening after lighting the altar lamp, Karma Dorji sat in meditation, but he gave up trying to follow the practices taught in the books. Late in the night, and sometimes till dawn, he remained sunk in a trance, dead to all sensations, to all cogitations, seeing himself as on a shore, watching the slowly mounting tide of a white luminous ocean ready to submerge him. Several months elapsed and then one day or one night, he did not know which, Karma Dorji felt that his body was being lifted from the cushion on which he was seated. Without changing his usual cross-legged attitude of meditation, he passed through the door and, floating in the air, traveled a long time. At last he arrived in his country, in his monastery. It was morning, the monks were coming out of the assembly hall. He recognized a number of them, officials, Tulkus, certain of his old mates. They appeared tired, painfully preoccupied, with dull, joyless faces and heavy gait. Karma examined them with curiosity. How puny and insignificant they seemed from the height where he now stood. How astonished, how awestruck they would be when in a moment he would appear to them enthroned in midair. and how those who had treated the low-born monk with contempt would prostrate themselves, trembling before the triumphant Dutob, the magician who baffled the apparent laws of nature. Then, as he dwelt on these ideas of victory, scorn awakened in the inmost depth of his mind and his elation subsided. He smiled in derision at the meanness of a revenge on such paltry puppets. They did not interest him any longer. His thoughts went out to the bliss of watching the flowing tide of the strange rippleless, white, luminous ocean. No, he would not show himself to the monks. That Karmadorji who had suffered in the monastery was as contemptible as those who had wickedly humiliated him. He rejected them altogether. Thus thinking, he started to leave the place. Then, suddenly, the monastery buildings were shaken and cracked. The neighboring mountains pitched and tossed in confusion, their summits tumbled on each other, while new ones arose. The sun crossed the sky like a thunderbolt and fell on the earth. Another sun sprang out, piercing the heavens, and the rhythm of the phantasmagoria went on with increasing speed till Karma discerned nothing but a kind of furious torrent whose foaming waves were made of all beings and things of the world. Visions of this kind are not very rare among Tibetan mystics. They must not be mistaken for dreams. The visionary is not asleep. Often, in spite of his imaginary peregrinations, the sensations he experiences and the scenery he perceives, he remains quite clearly conscious of his actual surroundings and of his own personality. Often, also, when going into a trance where they are liable to be interrupted, they quite consciously hope that none come by, or speak to them and trouble them in any other manner. Though they may be themselves incapable of speaking or moving, they hear and understand what is going on around them, but they do not feel connected with any material objects, all their interest being absorbed in the events and sensations of the trance. If that state of trance is abruptly broken by any exterior agent, or if he who experiences it has to break it himself by a strong effort, the shock that ensues is peculiarly painful and leaves a prolonged feeling of discomfort. It is to avoid these unpleasant effects and the consequences which they may have on the general health of those who suffer them, that rules have been devised for coming out of a period of ecstatic meditation, or even of ordinary meditation, if it has lasted for any length of time. As an instance, one is advised to turn the head slowly from one side to another, to massage the forehead and the crown of the head, to stretch the arms while clasping the hands behind the back and bending the body backward. There are numbers of similar exercises, and each one may choose whichever suits him best. The followers of the Zen sect in Japan, who meditate together in a common hall, appoint a kind of superintendent who is skilled in detecting when a monk is overcome by fatigue. He refreshes the fainting and revives their energy by striking them on one shoulder with a heavy stick. Those who have experienced it agree that the ensuing sensation is a most pleasant relaxation of the nerves. When he returned from his strange journey, Karmadorji found himself seated at his usual place in his cell. He curiously inspected the objects around him. His small room, with the books on the shelves, the altar, the hearth, was the same that he had seen the day before. Nothing had changed during the years that he lived in the Chimskang. He got up, looked through the window. The monastery, the valley, the woods wore their usual appearance. Nothing had changed, yet everything was different. Karma calmly lighted the fire and when the wood burnt brightly he cut his long hair and threw it into the flames. Then he made tea, drank and ate without haste, put some provisions in a bag and went out, carefully closing the Chimskang's door behind him. In the monastery he walked straight to the Tulku's mansion, and meeting a servant in the courtyard, he told him to inform his master that he was leaving and to convey him his gratitude for his kind hospitality. Then he left the Gompa. He had already gone some way when he heard somebody calling him. One of the young monks belonging to the Tulku household ran after him. "Kushog Rinpoche wishes to see you," he said. Karmadorji returned with him. "You leave us?" asked the Lama politely. "Where are you going to?" "To bow down at the feet of my guru and thank him," answered Karma. The Tulku remained silent for a while and then said sadly, My worshipful uncle is gone beyond sorrow. ” A reverential expression to say that Alamo is dead 6 months ago. 156 6 months ago. Kamadorji did not utter a single word. If you wish to go to his retod, continued the Lama, I will give you a horse, it shall be my parting gift. You will find one of Gushongtop's Jai's disciples living in the hermitage. Kama thanked his host but accepted nothing. A few days later, he again beheld the white little house from which he had seen the light springing and coming towards him. He entered the Lama's small private room where he had been admitted but once, remained long prostrated before the seat of the departed anchorite and spent the night in meditation. In the morning he took leave of his master's successor. The latter handed him a monastic toga that had belonged to the late hermit. Before he died, Kushongtop's Jais had expressly commanded that it should be given to him when he came out of his Chimskang. From that time on, Kamadorji led the life of an itinerant ascetic, somewhat like that of the famous Malerspa, whom he deeply venerated. When I happened to meet him, he was already old, but he did not appear to be thinking of settling anywhere. Few are the anchorites or other Naljorpas whose novitiate has proved so strange as that of Kama. It is because it is, indeed, quite peculiar that I have ventured to give so long an account of it. Nevertheless, the spiritual training of a disciple always includes a number of curious incidents. Many strange descriptions which I have heard, and my own experiences as a disciple on the heights of the Land of Snows, incline me to believe that most of them are perfectly authentic. Chapter 6, Psychic Sports. The Lungam Paranas. Under the collective term of Lungam, Tibetans include a large number of practices which combine mental concentration with various breathing gymnastics and aim at different results, either spiritual or physical. If we accept the belief current among the Lamaists, we ought to find the key to thaumaturgy in that curious training. Keen investigations do not, however, lead to extraordinary enthusiasm for the result obtained by those who have practiced it, seeking to acquire occult powers. Nevertheless, it would also be an error to deny that some genuine phenomena are produced by the adepts of Lungam. Though the effects ascribed to Lungam training vary considerably, the term Lungam is especially used for a kind of training which is said to develop uncommon nimbleness and especially enables its adepts to take extraordinarily long tramps with amazing rapidity. Belief in such a training and its efficacy has existed for many years in Tibet, and men who traveled with supernormal rapidity are mentioned in many traditions. We read in Malerspa's biography that at the house of the Lama who taught him black magic there lived a Trapa who was fleeter than a horse. Malerspa boasts of similar powers and says that he once crossed in a few days, a distance which, before his training, had taken him more than a month. He ascribes his gift to the clever control of internal air. However, it should be explained that the feat expected from the Lungam Pa is one of wonderful endurance rather than of momentary extreme fleetness. In this case, the performance does not consist in racing at full speed over a short distance as is done in our sporting matches, but of tramping at a rapid pace and without stopping during several successive days and nights. Beside having gathered information about the methods used in training Lungam Pa, I have been lucky enough to catch a glimpse of three adepts. In this I was extremely fortunate as, though a rather large number of monks endeavor to practice some kind of Lungam exercises, there is no doubt that very few acquire the desired result, and in fact true Lungam Pa must be very rare. I met the first Lungam Pa in the Chang Thang, an immense wild grassy region at a high level, inhabited only by a few tribes of nomad herdsmen living in tents. Literally Chang Thang means northern plain, but this term is used to designate any large tract of wild land, similar to the solitudes of northern Tibet. Towards the end of the afternoon, Yongnan, our servants and I were riding leisurely across a wide tableland, when I noticed, far away in front of us, a moving black spot which my field glasses showed to be a man. I felt astonished. Meetings are not frequent in that region. For the last 10 days we had not seen a human being. Moreover, men on foot and alone do not, as a rule, wander in these immense solitudes. Who could the strange traveler be? One of my servants suggested that he might belong to a trader's caravan which had been attacked by robbers and disbanded. Perhaps, having fled for life at night or otherwise escaped, he was now lost in the desert. That seemed possible. If such was really the case, I would take the lone man with us to some cowherd's encampment or wherever he might wish to go, if not far out of our route. But as I continued to observe him through the glasses, I noticed that the man proceeded at an unusual gait and, especially, with an extraordinary swiftness. Though, with the naked eyes, my men could hardly see anything but a black speck moving over the grassy ground, they too were not long in remarking the quickness of its advance. I handed them the glasses and one of them, having observed the traveler for a while, muttered, "Lama lungam parchig da.158. Written, Lama lungskom parchigra. It is like a lama lungam pa." These words Lama lungam pa at once awakened my interest. I had heard a great deal about the feats performed by such men and was acquainted with the theory of the training. I had, even, a certain experience of the practice, but I had never seen an adept of lungam actually accomplishing one of these prodigious tramps which are so much talked about in Tibet. Was I to be lucky enough to witness such a sight? The man continued to advance towards us and his curious speed became more and more evident. What was to be done if he really was a lungam pa? I wanted to observe him at close quarters. I also wished to have a talk with him, to put him some questions, to photograph him. I wanted many things. But at the very first words I said about it, the man who had recognized him as a Lama Lungam Pa exclaimed, "Your reverence will not stop the Lama, nor speak to him. This would certainly kill him. These Lamas when traveling must not break their meditation. The God who is in them escapes if they cease to repeat them gags, and when thus leaving them before the proper time, he shakes them so hard that they die." Put in that way, the warning seemed to express pure superstition. Nevertheless, it was not to be altogether disregarded. From what I knew of the technique of the phenomena, the man walked in a kind of trance. Consequently, a sudden awakening, though I doubt if it could cause death, would certainly painfully disturb the nerves of the runner. To what extent the shock would harm him I could not guess, and I did not want to make the Lama the object of a more or less cruel experiment. Other reasons also forbade me to gratify my curiosity. Tibetans had accepted me as a Lady Lama. They knew that I was a professed Buddhist and could not guess the difference existing between my philosophic conception of the Buddha's doctrine and Lamaist Buddhism. Common Tibetan folk completely ignore the fact that the term Buddhism includes a number of sects and views. So, in order to enjoy the confidence, respect and intimacy which my religious scar brought me, I was compelled to behave in close accordance with Tibetan customs, especially with religious ones. This was a serious hindrance, and often deprived my observations of a great part of their scientific interest, but it was the unavoidable price I had to pay for being admitted on ground still much more jealously guarded than the material territory of Tibet. This time, again, I had to repress my desire for full investigation and remain satisfied with the sight of the uncommon traveler. By that time he had nearly reached us. I could clearly see his perfectly calm, impassive face and wide open eyes with their gaze fixed on some invisible far distant object situated somewhere high up in space. The man did not run. He seemed to lift himself from the ground, proceeding by leaps. It looked as if he had been endowed with the elasticity of a ball and rebounded each time his feet touched the ground. His steps had the regularity of a pendulum. He wore the usual monastic robe and toga, both rather ragged. His left hand gripped a fold of the toga and was half hidden under the cloth. The right held a ferber. His right arm moved slightly at each step as if leaning on a stick, just as though the ferber, whose pointed extremity was far above the ground, had touched it and were actually a support. My servants dismounted and bowed their heads to the ground as the Lama passed before us, but he went his way apparently unaware of our presence. I thought I had done enough to comply with local customs by suppressing my desire to stop the traveler. I already began to vaguely regret it and thought that at any rate I would see some more of the affair. I ordered the servants to remount their beasts at once and follow the Lama. He had already covered a good distance, but without trying to overtake him, we did not let that distance increase and, with the glasses as well as with our naked eyes, my son and I looked continually at the Lungampa. It was no longer possible to distinguish his face, but we could still see the amazing regularity of his springy steps. We followed him for about 2 miles and then he left the track, climbed a steep slope and disappeared in the mountain range that edged the step. Riders could not follow that way and our observations came to an end. We could only turn back and continue our journey. I wondered if the Lama had, or had not, noticed that we were following him. Of course, though we were a good distance behind him, anyone in a normal state would have been aware of the presence of a troop of 6 riders. But, as I said, the traveler seemed to be in a trance and I could not therefore tell whether he was only pretending not to have seen us and climbed the hill to escape our inquisitive looks, or if he really did not know that he was being followed, and merely went in that direction because it was his way. On the morning of the 4th day after we had met the Lungampa, we reached the territory called Thebjai, where there are a number of scattered Dokpas. Dokpas, literally men of the solitudes, herdsmen. I did not fail to relate to the herdsmen how we had approached a Lama Lungampa as we joined the track that led to their pasture ground. Now some of the men had seen the traveler when gathering their cattle together at sunset the day before we had met him ourselves. From that information I made a rough reckoning. Taking into account the approximate number of hours we had actually traveled each day at the usual speed of our beasts, leaving out the time spent camping and resting, I came to the conclusion that in order to reach the place where we met him, the man, after he had passed near the Dokpas, must have tramped the whole night and next day, without stopping, at about the same speed as he was going when we saw him. To walk for 24 hours consecutively cannot be considered as a record by the hillmen of Tibet who are wonderful walkers. Lama Yongden and I, during our journey from China to Lhasa, have sometimes tramped for fully 19 hours, without stopping or refreshing ourselves in any way. One of these marches included the crossing of the High Deo Pass, knee-deep in the snow. However, our slow pace could not in any way be compared to that of the leaping Lungampa, who seemed as if carried on wings. And the latter had not started from Thebjai. Whence had he come and how far was he still going when we lost sight of him? Both were a mystery to me. The Dokpas thought that he might have come from Tsang, some monasteries of that province having a reputation as colleges for Lungam training in swiftness. Yet they had not spoken to him, and tracks coming from various directions join up on the Thebjai territory. Methodical investigations were impossible in these immense solitudes, or would have required several months of research, without any certainty of obtaining a satisfactory result. To undertake them was out of the question. I have just mentioned that monasteries in the Tsang province are renowned for training in swiftness. There is a legend which recounts the circumstances by which the most important of them, Shalagompa, was led to undertake the instruction and exercise of Lungampa runners. The heroes of that legend are two prominent lamas, Yongden Dorpal and the historian Bustan. The former was famous as a powerful magician who specialized in the coercion of terrible deities. Born about AD 1284, he is said to be the 7th of the successive reincarnations of Subhuti 161. A disciple of the historical Buddha 161, the line of whose reincarnations was continued, later on, by the Tashi Lamas, the present being the 16th reincarnation. Yongden Dorpal lived for a time at the court of the emperor of the Mongol dynasty which then ruled in China. His guru is said to have been a mystic lama whose name was Zhuang, of whom nothing seems to be known except through legends and rather fantastic traditions. Yongden Dorpal died at the age of 92 years. Bustan was born at Tho Phug in the vicinity of Shigatse in 1288. He wrote several books of history and arranged the Buddhist scriptures, translated from Sanskrit, into the present collection called Kagyu. This rite had to be accomplished every 12 years, or the deity would slay a sentient being every day to satisfy his hunger. The effect of the Dadabs is to bring Shinjd under the control of the Lama magician and to extort from him a promise, on his oath, to give up the slaughter of human beings for the 12 years. Some offerings are presented to him during the rite, and daily worship is instituted as a substitute for the lives which he has sworn to spare. Gluston heard of Youngton's intention and wishing to ascertain if his friend really possessed the power of coercing the terrible deity, he proceeded to the latter's temple accompanied by three other learned lamas. There he found that Shinsht had already answered Youngton's summons. His fearful form was as large as the sky, says the story. The magician told the lamas that they had just come in time to prove the extent of their love and compassion. He had, he said, coerced the god for the sake of humanity, now it was necessary to feed him so that he might be propitiated, and he suggested that one of the lamas should offer himself as victim. The three companions of Buston declined the invitation under various pretexts and took hasty leave. Buston remained alone with Youngton and declared that if the success of the rite really required the sacrifice of a human life which would prevent the daily slaughter of a being for 12 years, he was ready to walk into the wide open mouth of Shinsht. To this generous proposal the magician replied that he could manage to secure the purpose of the Dadabs without his friend sacrificing his life, but he would entrust to him and his lineal successors the charge of performing the prescribed rite every 12 years. Gluston having accepted the responsibility, Youngton, by his magic power, created countless phantom doves and threw them into Shinsht's mouth. Since then, the successive incarnations of Lama Buston who ruled over Shalagompa, have kept up the celebration of the propitiating ceremony. It seems that, as time went on, Shinsht acquired some companions, for the Shali Lamas now speak of many demons who are evoked upon that occasion. A runner is required to gather these demons from various parts. This runner is called Makatang. The name Mei is taken from the buffalo on which Shinsht rides. This animal is said to be fearless and consequently dares to call the evil spirits. At least, such is the explanation given at Shalu. The elected runner is alternatively a monk from Nyang Tod Kyid Phug or one from Samding. Those who aspire to play the part of Makatang undertake a preliminary training in either of the above-mentioned monasteries. The training consists in breathing exercises practiced during a strict seclusion in complete darkness, which lasts 3 years and 3 months. Amongst these exercises the following one enjoys the greatest favor amongst those many Tibetan ascetics who are not of an especially intellectual type. The student sits cross-legged on a large and thick cushion. He inhales slowly and for a long time, just as if he wanted to fill his body with air. Then, holding his breath, he jumps up with legs crossed, without using his hands and falls back on his cushion, still remaining in the same position. He repeats that exercise a number of times during each period of practice. Some lamas succeed in jumping very high in that way. Some women train themselves in the same manner. As one can easily believe, the object of this exercise is not acrobatic jumping. According to Tibetans, the body of those who drill themselves for years, by that method, become exceedingly light, nearly without weight. These men, they say, are able to sit on an ear of barley without bending its stalk or to stand on the top of a heap of grain without displacing any of it. In fact, the aim is levitation. A curious test has been devised, and the student who passes it with success is believed capable of performing the feats here above mentioned or, at least, of approaching proficiency. A pit is dug in the ground, its depth being equal to the height of the candidate. Over the pit is built a kind of cupola whose height from the ground level to its highest point again equals that of the candidate. A small aperture is left at the top of the cupola. Now between the man seated cross-legged at the bottom of the pit and that opening, the distance is twice the height of his body. For instance, if the man's height is 5 feet 5 inches, the top hole will be at 10 feet 10 inches from the pit's bottom. The test consists in jumping cross-legged, as during the training exercises which I have described, and coming out through the small opening at the top of the cupola. I have heard campers declare that this feat has been performed in their country, but I have not myself witnessed anything like it. According to information which I have gathered on the spot, the final test that consecrates the success of candidate calling buffaloes is accomplished somewhat differently. After their seclusion in darkness for 3 years, those monks who deem themselves capable of going successfully through the test, proceed to Shala, where they are immured in one of the grave-like huts which I have already described. But, at Shala, the opening is in the side of the cell,